This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
May it please the court. I come here today a humble pro se before a panel of five distinguished justices.
Hold on. Is that counsel for the case?
I generated that.
I'm sorry?
I generated that? That is not a real person.
Okay, it would have been nice to know that when you made your application. You did not tell me that, sir. I received the application. And you have appeared before this court and been able to testify verbally in the past. You have gone to my clerk's office and held verbal conversations with our staff for over 30 minutes. Okay? I don't appreciate being misled.
The pressure to adopt new legal technologies, notably including artificial intelligence, continues to increase as lawyers, law firms, and their clients look for new efficiencies and tools to improve the practice of law. But these tools aren't always easy to adopt. Pilot programs, costs, fears of new technology, security and privacy concerns, and even more are part of the package. Sukesh Kamra leads the Tories law firm's knowledge and innovation team, having spent two decades at the intersection between knowledge management, AI, and legal technology. He has twice been named one of Canada's most influential lawyers, and he joins me on the podcast to talk about the opportunities and challenges of adopting new technologies for legal services. Two programming notes. First, this episode qualifies for 45 minutes of professionalism content for the Law Society of Ontario's continuing legal education requirements. In fact, it is part of a series of Law Bites episodes that have now received accreditation from the LSO. These include past episodes with Abdi Aidid and Amy Salazin on AI and the law. I'll soon have a full post on what I'm calling the Law Bites Professionalism Pack, which features enough hours to cover the professionalism requirement for a year. Second, after this episode, Law Bites will break for the month of August. New episodes will resume early in the fall. Now on to Sukesh Kamra. Sukesh, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
It's so nice to have you join. You know, we've known each other for a very long time. You're one of the very first graduates in our law and tech program at the University of Ottawa, well over 20 years ago, not to date you. I think myself as well, but nevertheless, it's an amazing to see your involvement in law and technology and in particular in how it relates to legal practice. And I'm so glad you come on the podcast to talk about it. Why don't we start there, though, a little bit of review of that kind of career arc. And I'm curious, just how common is it for law firms to have people that are focused on your area, on implementing and adopting technology into legal practice?
Yeah, I started as a technology law lawyer after graduating from the University of Ottawa with the Master's in Law and Technology program. And I always had an interest in the business side of the practice. How do lawyers work? Are they efficient when they practice? Do they have access to tools to make them more efficient? Those are some of the questions that I was always interested in. So I took on a role in the knowledge management space with a large seven sister law firm. And I learned a lot about lawyers, their mindset, their ways of working. I moved on to become a director of knowledge management at another large national Bay Street firm where I managed a team of knowledge management professionals. And I had leadership coaching there, which was amazing. It was 12 months of leadership training. When you go to law school, you don't get that leadership training, but that was instrumental in learning not just about sort of knowledge management and innovation, but how to actually lead a team when you're looking at this sort of function. I then proceeded to be the national director of knowledge and innovation at a large international firm where I got the first glimpse of artificial intelligence in the practice of law. And seeing that through the lens of different regions around the world was such a rewarding experience for me. And now at Tories, of course, being chief of knowledge and innovation, where I lead a large team of lawyers and professionals seeking ways to create efficiency in the practice while also leveraging content, people, process, and technology. Now, not every firm has roles like the ones I've had. The larger Bay Street firms have had knowledge management lawyers in the past, and some had directors when I started back in 2004, but it was never a chief function. And often knowledge management reported into a separate function like IT or operations. So the function has grown tremendously since I started. These roles now actually have a seat at the table. They manage their own budget. They hire people, often lawyers. It's a strategic function at both law firms and many of the in-house teams as well. And it's a team of interdisciplinary professionals. So you've got lawyers, educators, technology experts, some developers in there. The value is in that package of skills, and that's something we've never had before.
Okay. So what an interesting space to be operating in. You know, as you were going through that career arc, you mentioned when AI first sort of popped its head when you moved internationally and had a chance to see what was taking place. But obviously your work predates in some ways some of the current boom we've seen in AI and the interest in AI. Can you reflect a bit on the tech adoption curve in law firms? How do law firms differ? How do lawyers themselves differ when it comes to some of these kinds of issues?
Listen, Michael, it's a steep adoption curve. There's several reasons for this, I think. I think lawyers are skeptical by nature. It's the fear of the unknown, right? They will always ask the why question. Why should I be using these technologies? Can these pre-AI technologies really help me in my practice? How can I pass on what I do every day to some piece of software? Especially if I've practiced without these tools for many years, why do I need to change now? So all of these are really great questions, I think, particularly given the fact that lawyers are creatures of habit. We like doing the same things each day. The moment you introduce something new, like technology, that alters the things we do every day, I think there's inevitably going to be a bit of reluctance. There's the liability issue, of course, right? As lawyers, we have unlimited liability. I'm more comfortable if I retain control over how I work and the output of my work. And I have less control if I give some portion of that work to a piece of technology. Now, the one caveat here, I would say, is that lawyers who are just entering the practice and have never practiced before, technology is just simply embedded in the way they practice law. And so they don't need to unlearn anything. The unlearning piece, in my opinion, can sometimes be the hardest part of the adoption curve. So that's one key element there. The other is the training piece. Right? So do I need to learn something new now? Is there in-depth training required? All of this takes away from my billable work and my time. I already have to, as a lawyer, need to learn core technologies at a law firm, like a document management system, a practice management system, docketing and time entry technology. Then there are point solutions which solve for specific pain points that I need to learn as well. And then on top of that, you've got all these generative AI tools that are now coming to the forefront that I need to learn how to prompt before I receive some good output. There's the cultural and philosophical differences amongst law firms, of course, that impacts adoption. Some firms have it ingrained in their culture, as we do here at Tories, that we ought to be using technology to make life easier for ourselves and be efficient in how we deliver legal services to our clients. Now, there's some practice areas as well that lend themselves better to technology adoption than others. For instance, startup and venture capital practices, practices that might be a little bit more forms driven, or practices that might be repetitive in their daily tasks, tend to use technology more, particularly if there are fee sensitivities attached to them. What is interesting, though, about the current generative AI boom is that it seems to be different. There is some of these Gen AI technologies that really feel like they understand at least some elements of practicing law. And this is what is different than some of the other forms of technology that we've had. It just feels different. And that's what I think is pulling the legal community towards generative AI.
Okay, that's interesting. And I want to come back to AI in just a sec. I mean, you've touched on it a little bit already, but you know, I understand sometimes the perspective of a lawyer, those that have spent years practicing in one way and now are being asked to adjust, or those that haven't practiced at all and so are perhaps more adept or more comfortable with incorporating some of these technologies off the bat. But having been at a number of different law firms, what kind of factors do you think firms need to consider when they start thinking about adopting on a firm-wide basis some of these new legal technologies?
I think there's a push for organizations to be very operational when it comes to legal technology. Take a simple example. I have a legal problem. I see a technology solution that I attended a webinar on. I think if I apply that solution to the problem, I might be able to solve that problem. Therefore, I will go and purchase that solution to solve my problem. Very short-sighted, very operational. I think what we need to do as a legal industry is really think strategically in our approach. We often don't understand the downstream impact of our day-to-day decisions because they can sometimes be a little short-sighted. So I think it's important to be strategic. And I will always say to ask that why question before you ask the how question. And so in my view, I think there are three things to consider when being strategic around implementing legal technology in a law firm setting. The first is start with a business problem, right? So identify a specific task or issue where you feel legal technology could potentially assist based on the collective input of your people. Typically, you would do a listening tour, right? Talk to your people, hear from your people, and most importantly, see from your people. A lot of times you'll hear lawyers say, this is an issue. What you need to do is actually go with them to their desk and see what they're doing on their computer screen to understand truly what the issue might be, particularly with associates and law clerks, because they're the two that are really working in the trenches and may feel some of those daily pain points that require attention. So number one, identify that business problem. Number two, I'll say find the right fit for your organization. Does the new legal technology you're thinking about fit within your firm's strategy and culture? And you should get access to your firm's strategy before you think about implementing any legal technology. You'd hate to vet a new piece of software based on a few people's needs and then realize the firm is actually considering abandoning a particular practice area. So really important to have that strategy in front of you. I would also say focus on what your firm or your in-house team does best, right? A particular area of law where you excel, where the new technology can help you create a real competitive advantage. And if you're not ready to look at legal technology on the practice of law side, there are many, many opportunities that exist on the business services side of the house. Marketing newsletters, business development proposals, HR policies, procedures, a lot of technology that can help you create and disseminate a lot of that content. In fact, I would say if you're trying a new piece of technology for the first time, you may want to try it on a lower value use case where you can leverage non-client data. So that's number two. Number three, I will say be intentional and thoughtful in your approach. Have a framework statement right at the outset. I want to try this or these specific tools to address this common pain point that I hear at our firm. Because vetting and adopting new technology can be very daunting. It can be time consuming. It is extremely resource intensive. And often you don't even know where to begin. And so asking the vendor for help, right? Taking advantage of vendor resources, materials, their expertise, they know the product way better than any of us do. What are other organizations saying about the product? Ask the vendor to speak about the differentiators of their product versus others in the market. Do a deep dive. One of the questions I like to ask vendors is, what is the least impressive feature or functionality of your tool? Right? Because everybody will have that best foot forward. I want to hear where you're struggling right now, because that might be a pain point that I see if I'm trying to implement this technology in our law firm. And so if you can focus in on those three sort of strategic pieces, then you can move on to a pilot. And in the pilot, there's quite a bit of work to be done, right? Pre-work, you want to make sure you detail the risk management and information security assessment. Where is the data coming from? Where is it flowing? What's the governance around the data? What about encryption technology to safeguard sensitive legal information, audit trails? You might have firm policies imposed by your organization in terms of what's your level of business risk. Do we need client consent if we are going to use client data in this particular piece of technology? What about access controls? Who can see, who cannot see your data? Then there's OCGs, outside counsel guidelines, may limit the types of permitted uses in terms of the cases that you can use the tools for. Readiness assessment, this is a big one. Are you as an organization ready for the behavioral change that comes with the technology, the new ways of working, the associated costs with that? What I'm hearing a lot in the industry right now is pilot fatigue. There is just so much change in legal technology and law firms. You know, are we ready to take on yet another pilot, yet another proof of concept, yet another deployment into the organization? Clients also want to know what we're doing with legal technology. And sometimes you may want to partner with a client and do a co-pilot, for example, of a particular piece of technology. If you are doing a pilot, you want to make sure you've got a detailed pilot plan. What are we doing this for? How are we doing this? Who is doing this? What does success look like? Is it about time savings? Is it about less administrative burden on the lawyers? Is it about making life easier? What are we trying to get out of this? Most importantly, I would say we want to also make sure that we demonstrate the what's in it for me, right? It is crucial to get lawyer buy-in when you're looking at implementing legal technology. Picking that use case again where you might know the expected outcome without the technology, and then comparing that and looking at the delta when you're actually using that technology, when you know what the outcome is, and comparing the two, I think is really important. And lastly, I will say, you know, as you're doing your pilot, you're going to do a lot of testing. There's going to be a lot of training involved, troubleshooting. Seek feedback, right? Reward adoption. Get your people to actually use these technologies. Where does it work? Where does it not work? Tell a story at the end of the day. Some of these tools will work well in certain situations, and others, it won't work. And it's okay. It's okay to say it didn't work well in this particular space, and we learned from it and go from there.
You know, it's striking just the amount of assessment and technical expertise that's needed. You know, how much of this are firms able to do in-house, either in sometimes creating their own tools or at least having the expertise to walk through much of what you're talking about? Or is there a heavy reliance in many instances on the vendors that you mentioned to provide the support that's necessary?
It really depends, Michael, on the firm and their level of expertise and resourcing, as you mentioned. I think there's always been a debate between buy versus build legal technology. Sometimes when you look at buy, it might not, you know, solve for every pain point because they've got to build something that's universal. Build might be something where you can actually identify the pain point and specifically answer that question by building it yourself, but there are a lot of risks that come with that as well. I would say most firms simply just don't have the resourcing to build, and they've turned to low-code platforms in the last number of years to say if we can sort of, you know, you don't need to be a coder or a full-stack developer to build stuff in a low-code environment. You can have citizen developers build point solutions using low-code platforms, but these are point solutions aimed at solving a point or an issue. When you're looking at enterprise-wide solutions that the entire firm would use or the majority of your people would use, you're typically looking to purchase. Now, with automation technology and the advent now of generative AI, we're trying to see, you know, is there a combination? And we think there is a combination of build and buy, where you can build perhaps the underlying platforms, but then buy, sorry, you can sort of buy the underlying platforms and then build on top of those specific applications or solutions. Which is a healthy balance between ensuring you've got enterprise-wide security and deployment with these, you know, buy solutions, but then being able to build specific pointed solutions because a particular practice group might need something that doesn't come through when on the buy side.
Okay, interesting. Now, if you do move in the buy side, and it sounds like in many instances you're going to need some of that, you mentioned some of the kinds of questions that you typically ask vendors. Can you talk perhaps a bit more about some of the kinds of things that you focus on when you're talking with developers or vendors on a particular product? They obviously have their sales pitch. They're going to focus on features from the law firm side. What are the kinds of things that you're thinking about and asking about?
I think one of the first ones, Michael, is again, if we're going to use client data, it's very important to understand where is the data going throughout the life cycle of that data, right? So not just on the, I'm now interacting with the piece of software, I've put some piece of information in there right at that moment, all the way through to me finishing my interaction with that tool. What is happening with the data? Who is seeing it? Where is it going? And that's where your risk management team gets involved. And you look at your outside counsel guidelines. Every client has, you know, certain differences in terms of some of those outside counsel guidelines, and some of them have a baseline which we can't deviate from. And so having your risk management team involved right at the outset, talking to the vendor's team around, you know, where is the data going and how is it being governed, is extremely important. I think number two, IT concerns around data security, cyber breach, all those specific elements around data security have to be at the forefront when it comes to you know, looking at some of these tools. I think number three, you know, one of the things I've used in my practice over the 21 years I've been doing this is when you're thinking about some of these features, you're thinking right away at how are lawyers going to be adopting this in their day-to-day workflow. And there's this concept of rule of seven that I've always used in my practice, which is to say, once we get through some of these risk management and IT concerns, and we're ready to sort of think about leveraging some of these features and functionalities, how am I going to get my people to use this? So I think that there are seven different opportunities for you to get in front of people to get them to just beyond the features and functionality. So it might be at a practice group meeting. It might be a video that you send to them. It might be conversations in a boardroom or in a hallway to get them excited about this, because you need to go beyond just compatibility and security. One of the things we have at Tori's, which I love, is we have a focus group that we use to vet features, functionality, and really get to the nitty-gritty of how we're going to use this in the day-to-day workflow of the lawyers. And this focus group has been meeting for years now, every sort of 6 weeks or so. And they are the associates, senior associates, junior associates, law clerks that are getting on the front end doing the work and asking them, you know, how are you going to use this specific feature? Because the vendor is saying this is how they see it being used by other firms, but how do you think you're going to be using this? Are you going to be using this? We leverage our legal services center in Halifax, which is amazing. We have a dedicated group of about 30 individuals there that are looking at technology and process improvement, and they're all lawyers by background. And so they're testing some of these features. They're looking at where it works and where it doesn't work. And what we do to sort of finish this off is we do an annual review of each of our tools when they're coming up for renewal to see what new features are there. Do we really need generative AI if what we're really trying to do is just automate a certain provision in a contract? Maybe we just need simple logic or document automation that doesn't require generative AI. So it's really important to go beyond just what we're hearing from the vendors, you know, go beyond some of the security and compatibility issues and really think through how is this going to work in the day-to-day workflow of our practicing lawyers.
Okay, a lot of really interesting considerations. I find it really fascinating that you've got a focus group that's meeting as regularly as it does, thinking about some of these things. I'm going to guess that much of their discussion of late has focused on AI, and you've already raised it in a number of instances. How has the advent of many kinds of AI technologies changed the emphasis on tech adoption? Do you sense skepticism? Is it trepidation? Is it excitement? A combination of all of those things. You know, how have firms been sort of dealing with this sort of just explosion of interest and availability of different kinds of AI tools?
I mean, listen, like most new technologies, and we've gone through, you know, mobile technology, we've gone through cloud, and now we're going through generative AI. I think we're going to go through a maturity curve, right? The first year or so, I've seen quite a bit of skepticism, trepidation, mostly based on a lack of understanding, right? What is this AI? We talked about these types of AIs years ago, corrective AI and extractive AI. And so all of a sudden, this generative AI, what is this? Can I trust it? Does it actually work? I think there was a little bit of a sales pitch that needed to happen in the first year or so of this. And I think most lawyers were not entirely sold on this technology in the legal industry. So some of that skepticism, again, comes from the fact that we experienced, you know, what we experienced with machine learning AI, which promised so much, yet in some ways delivered much less than the hype. We're almost sort of starting from below zero to get people to say, no, this is different. This generative AI is a little bit different. It's here's how it is different. Here's how we think it will make an impact on your day-to-day life when you practice law. So there's a little bit of an internal sales job that we have to do with lawyers in the industry. I would say over the last few months, we seem to have turned the corner, right? So more clients are asking about analysis of pilots that we're running in generative AI and how are they impacting certain areas of practice. Clients themselves are starting to use generative AI tools and are more open to asking law firms to use them. Before, the outside counsel guidelines would say something like, you know, unless you can really speak to these specific issues, I'd rather you not use generative AI on our matters. And what we're starting to now see is we actually would like you to use generative AI so long as you can satisfy these three or four criteria for us. And a lot of it is, again, security of our data, making sure the models are not learning from our data. So they're really starting to put the emphasis on efficiency, making life easier, and starting to understand some of these tools actually are business-ready tools. And so law firms are responding, right? And so what that means for a law firm is you need a special group of knowledge and innovation lawyers or legal operation professionals who are doing the heavy lifting, without which none of this excitement actually could be backed up with actual substance, right? Because you have to curate the content, put the content in a repository that the generative AI model can read and properly understand and give you some outputs that are reasonable. So I think we're in that maturity curve right now, Michael, and I think we've turned a bit of that corner because now you're really starting to see engagement, not only within law firms, but between the client and the law firm.
Okay, that's interesting. It's interesting to see that shift. You know, so you identified what some of the initial concerns might have been, that initial skepticism. Looking ahead for the next couple of years, where do you foresee some of the kinds of concerns arising with respect to some of these AI tools?
Yeah, listen, I mean, confidentiality, data privacy is still going to be number one. You know, as law firms and in the legal industry, we're working with sensitive data, right? That is the nature of the data we handle. So confidentiality and data privacy concerns will always be there. Hallucinations, of course, with generative AI, it's sort of built into the product. Accuracy, reliability, the output, I think that is something that as lawyers, particularly as lawyers, we're looking for perfection, right? We're not okay with 80%. We want 100% in many instances. So we're going to have to grapple with that sort of accuracy, reliability, and hallucination, and where are we comfortable with? And that's going to be a concern moving forward as well. Lack of explainability has always been a bit of an issue. I think lawyers could understand extractive AI, because if we said to a machine learning tool, here are 100 change of control provisions, now that you know what this is, can you go fetch for me the 50 from these 50 agreements? Like, just logically, it kind of made sense. I'm teaching you, you're learning, go find it. With generative AI, there still is a lack of explainability in most instances. And so it's hard to sort of understand the audit behind how this technology works. Bias and discrimination, I think, is going to be there probably for the next little while, unless we try to figure that out. Client consent for use, I think, is another one. We talked a little bit about that, but in what instances are we going to see maybe a reduction of client consent? Maybe that's not a big concern moving forward, versus some, you know, in institutional clients or industries where I think they're heavily regulated, where maybe they still need to ask for consent, and we're going to have to ask for consent. Over-reliance, I think, possibly leading to de-skilling of some of the core legal reasonings might be one of the bigger concerns in the near future, particularly as we give more legal work to these artificial intelligence tools. Are we losing legal reasoning? Are we losing critical thinking? You know, all things that we have to look at. And then behavioral change, right? So we're going to now disrupt some of the current workflows, and in some instances, only for marginal gains and high costs, because these tools are still relatively expensive. So what is, you know, where is that concern going to be with behavior? Is that going to change over time? I think it's still going to be there for the foreseeable future. But so those are some of the big concerns I think we should be looking at over the next year or two.
Okay, interesting. You mentioned hallucinations. I'm curious if that's an issue that you are encountering or some of your lawyers are encountering. I know that there's been times where I've put stuff into ChatGPT or some of the other services out there, and I end up with these cases that don't seem right. And of course, you dig a little further and they're simply not. They're partially right, partially wrong. And that's where you get into these hallucinations. Is this something that your lawyers are encountering as well?
We are, absolutely. I mean, generative AI, just the foundational understanding of how generative AI works is it is going to hallucinate, right? It is trying to predict the next word. And yes, we're getting into agentic AI, and yes, we're getting into reasoning AI with these models, which is great, but we're just starting in that space. I think the basis behind which these hallucinations are happening are still happening, and they will happen. And the challenge, I think, is when you give it a large corpus of content, or you ask it a question that is, you know, too generic, you might get an answer that is prone to hallucination, versus pointing it to a smaller data set and saying, within this data set, can you find me, you know, a provision and make it more buyer friendly or seller friendly based on this content that I give you? You know, one of the challenges that we've noticed with some of the legal research products out there, and they are getting better, but we're starting to still see that there is hallucination. And I think it's because the body of content is so big. And so it's looking at such a large corpus of content that it can trip over what it's trying to say and give you answers that might not be accurate.
Yeah, no, I think you're right about that. You know, you mentioned that it's some of the junior associates that are often the easiest to convince, or at least naturally adapt to some of the newer kinds of technologies. I'm curious about what you think these technologies, especially in AI, are going to mean for those associates and hiring practices and the kind of training that has often been part and parcel with being a younger lawyer. And as we move towards using AI in particular, for things like due diligence and document review, which used to be within the purview of many of those lawyers. What do you think it's going to mean for associates and perhaps even for hiring practices more broadly for law firms?
I think there's a risk and reward here, Michael. I think people automatically think that we will require less lawyers to do these types of legal tasks. And I'm not entirely convinced that that is the case. I think in some instances, yes, but I'm not sure that means less lawyers for the work that we do. I think the early career legal work, the tasks that were training grounds for our associates, we will need to find other ways to train the associates because some of that will be done, if not all of that will be done with the technologies that we currently have, particularly with AI. But I also think that AI can help create scenario-based learning of how to do document review or due diligence or e-discovery or mock-ups. So I think as much as it might be taking away some of the mundane tasks that perhaps we don't even want to do as junior associates, it can also create scenarios for us to learn from. And so I think there's a nice give and take there. I think skill building tasks will be required for associates, and there's an opportunity for law firms and in-house folks to redesign the law firm training model and rethink how we train our associates. I think we should reward human judgment, measure the tech literacy and strategic outputs and not just the hours that we're spending on this sort of stuff. Skill set expansion, associates, I think, who understand both law and technology will have a competitive advantage, I think, over those that don't. In fact, a lot of our clients are saying would love for your associates to come and explain to us how generative AI is being used. What are the tools out there in the market? As an in-house team or as a GC, what are some of the tools I should be thinking about? You know my industry, you work on these deals for us every day. Hey, associate, come and teach us how these tools work and which tools I should be actually thinking about, because as a general counsel, I don't have a tremendous amount of time to see the plethora of generative AI tools that are popping up on the market every day. I do think there'll be more time for higher value work. So maybe that means we need more seasoned lawyers. But then again, how do you get to seasoned lawyers when you still have to train the juniors? I will say on the client side, we're starting to see more legal operation roles on teams. And so before, the knowledge and innovation team at the law firm side didn't necessarily have a counterpart on the client side, but now we're starting to see those legal operation roles. Those are individuals that are looking at generative AI. And so think about collaboration, and maybe there's cross-training between those on the in-house side and those at a law firm side for a more rounded sort of cross-functional service delivery team when it comes to problem solving. All of this, I think, will certainly impact the hiring of lawyers in practice more broadly. I think there is an opportunity for us as an industry, educators, law schools, legal tech companies and law firms, in-house teams to actually get together and have an open and honest discussion, because this technology is rapidly improving. What we saw with sort of version one of GPT and some of these other tools a couple of years ago is so distant in the memory in terms of what it can do these days. And I think we really need to start thinking about that longer term impact on the practice.
Yeah, no, it's interesting how this is such a big part of how law firms are as they think about these issues. Same thing is happening within our law school and the delivery of legal education. Clearly you've been at a number of some of the largest law firms in the country. Those I think many would see as the haves when it comes to some of these sorts of technologies. I mean, they can afford to put in you and a team of people around some of these issues and have focus groups and have so many different kinds of things built around this. Is there a risk that we're going to find within the legal community more broadly sort of haves and have-nots, where some of the advantages that some of the law firms, larger law firms have in being able to adopt these technologies will really in some ways increase the kind of competitive advantages they have? Or do you think that some of these tools will open the door to allow smaller firms to do things that they previously weren't able to do and perhaps close the gap a little bit?
You know, I'm torn on this one, Michael. This is one where I'm, if you'd asked me this question several months ago or even a year or two ago, I would have said, not really. I don't think there's a big difference. But the more this technology improves and the more you're starting to see law firms adopt this technology at scale, and the more the technology really truly understands the practice of law, the more I'm leaning towards I think there might be a distinction between those that have these pieces of technology and those that don't. You know, as a very simple example, I'll say to you, and I'm sure you've heard of this, you know, mental health is a big issue within the legal community, and I know we're really working hard to try to solve for this. But imagine as a lawyer, you're working at a law firm and you have access to these generative AI tools that is going to make your life easier and impact your mental health, where you might have an extra hour or two at the end of the day to do something not related to law, versus those organizations that may not have the financial means to purchase some of these technologies. You know, how does that impact the lawyer at that firm from a mental health perspective, right? I mean, again, this is a very simple example, but I think it does speak to that have and have not piece. What I will say, though, is the cost of these technologies is coming down, right? As you can expect, there's more competition. I subscribe to a news feed that tells me every week the new number of generative AI solutions that are out there. And I think every sort of week I see about 10 new ones. It's over 500 new technologies that are embedding some form of generative AI in there. And that's putting pressure on pricing, and that's starting to bring pricing down. So will we, in a few years' time, see that the price between a really, really good generative AI tool and one that might be not as good, that delta might be smaller, so that those firms that can't employ people or don't have the resources to purchase these technologies, maybe that delta is going to be at a point where it's just going to be embedded in a lot of the tools that we use. We're already seeing it with Microsoft, for example, right? Most organizations, small or big, if you're not a Google shop, you're a Microsoft shop or one of those big players, it's already coming with Copilot, right? And Copilot now has reasoning built into it. So you're getting the best of Copilot's version of generative AI. So I think at some point there will be the delta will sort of decrease, but I think right now there is a bit of the delta between those that have and don't have. I will also say, you know, is there an ideal scenario where, you know, work given by clients might be given to those law firms that have some of these technologies versus those that don't have these technologies? And what does that mean for the legal industry, right? This is another one that we're keeping our eye on. So I think a couple of years ago, probably not. I think right now, I think there is a have and have not. But I wonder if in the future, if cost does come down and resourcing costs come down, that there won't be a big enough difference. We're already seeing a lot of organizations look at generative AI for underprivileged communities, right? And access to justice, and saying, listen, there is a valid use case for some of these tools to help those that cannot afford legal service. So I think we're headed towards what I think is probably more of a less of a delta, but that delta right now, in my opinion, is quite big.
Okay. Yeah. Why don't we close with this? You talked a bit about where things might be in the next couple of years and the prospect of these technologies becoming more accessible and more affordable. You know, you've lived through, as you mentioned, mobile and cloud. And of course, everyone lived through COVID and the shift to some of the adoption of technologies to continue to live and work in that environment. Where do you see things 5 years, 10 years even from now with respect to the intersection of law firms and artificial intelligence?
I mean, between not being able to predict the pandemic, Michael, and not knowing what generative AI until only a couple of years ago, I don't know if we can predict anything these days. But if I had to, I would say a few things. I think number one, right now there's a lot of optionality within existing legal technology tools to either turn on AI or not to turn on AI. I think in a few years' time, these tools will have generative AI embedded within the tools. It will be a given that optionality likely won't exist. So that's, I think, one big change. I think number two, high-end automation. I think right now it's really focused in on some of the lower value daily routine tasks. I think some of those tasks, we're already starting to see some of this, won't just be mundane tasks. There will be tasks that are highly skilled. There'll be tasks that require a little bit more judgment. Some of that will be automating, leveraging some of these generative AI and non-generative AI, just automation technology that is going to continue to grow. I think analysis and legal risk issues, technology will start to play a bigger role in. Agentic AI, as I said, is only a few months into existence, and we're already starting to see very simple things like, hey, can you make this provision more seller friendly? As I said, in the past, you'd have to research it and figure out what you have in your precedent bank and then go to a senior partner, perhaps, to say, how should I frame this in this particular industry with this client? But now we're starting to see generative AI, particularly on the agentic side, start to do that. Drafting entire agreements, right? We're not there yet, but I think the lawyer's role will become more of a review and refine as opposed to draft. And that I think is coming. Flagging anomalies for risk without human input. Right now, we are still overseeing what comes out of generative AI. I think 5 to 10 years, you know, I question how much input from a human will be required to flag some of those anomalies. Regulatory compliance, big piece for a lot of clients in the various regulated industries. A lot of manual input of, you know, here's what the legislation says, here's how it impacts what we do in a particular industry. I think a lot of that will be automated. Persuasion, defending a position. I think technology will be playing a key role in that. Will it do it by itself? Will it go to court for us? I think it's hard to say at this particular stage, but we're starting to see signs that it might be able to do some of that in the near future. At the end of the day, I think legal service delivery has changed and the lawyer mindset is changing. What we need to figure out now over the next few years is where does each one of these puzzle pieces fit, right? The lawyer, the AI, the work we do, and the client. And how do we do it in a manner that satisfies the end goal, which may be very different for each law firm and for each client? What I can say is that this is an exciting time to be in the legal profession, especially at a firm like Torrey's, where we're leading the way in AI and automation technology adoption in the practice of law. And I think for all lawyers in the legal industry, this is a monumental time to be at the forefront of trying to understand where this technology can make life easier for us as we practice law.
Well, definitely never a dull moment. It sounds like over the last 20 odd years of focusing on knowledge management and then on technology and now on AI. And if this comes to pass in the way you've just described, it's pretty clear that the next decade is going to be similarly interesting, challenging, and I think providing some really exciting opportunities for certainly for you, but I think for the legal profession more broadly.
Absolutely. Looking forward to the next several years.
Absolutely. Sukesh, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your work and the intersection between AI technology and the practice of the law.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. That's LAWBYTES at POBox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter at LawBitesPod or follow Michael Geist at MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe at iTunes, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening and see you next time.